This podcast delves into the dark, the depraved, and all things to keep you up at night. Listener discretion is advised. Now, sit back, pull the covers over your head, and allow yourself to be taken on a journey through the abyss.
Hey, hey there, pod people. Thanks for tuning into another episode of Through the Abyss podcast. I'm your co-host, Mandy.
And this is Ben.
And we are going to be delving into the life and crimes of Edmund Amel Kemper III. I know it's weird say, but he's my favorite serial killer.
Weird. There shouldn't be a favorite serial killer.
I can't help it. I like this guy.
You could say, but you could phrase it different. You could say, I find this serial killer to be the most fascinating, but to say he's your favorite is weird.
I don't care. I'm going to proclaim my weirdness. he's my favorite. He's actually still alive. I've been contemplating whether or not to write him, so I don't know if I ever will or not.
I mean, I think if you write him, there's a good chance that within the next year, you will be his wife.
Yeah, that would never happen. He's like almost 80. No, thank you.
Yeah, but you love him.
I don't love him. I said I like him. There's a difference, fool.
Okay.
Anywho, so Kemper was born in Burbank, California on December 18th, 1948 to Clarnell Stage and Edmund Amel Kemper Jr. Very intelligent, has an IQ of 136, but I think he's actually tested higher than when he's in prison. But he displayed sociopathic behavior from a young age. He used to torture and kill animals. He acted out bizarre sexual rituals with his sister's dolls and once said that in order to kiss a teacher he had a crush on, he'd have to kill her. Interesting. Huh. So worsening the situation was Kemper's mom, who constantly berated and humiliated him, often made him sleep in a locked basement due to fear that he would molest his sisters. His mom, Clarnell, apparently suffered from borderline personality disorder, which resulted in her rages and abuse against her son. She was awful to him. Great to his sisters, but absolutely horrible to him.
As a lot of things are, but like generally directly abuse related. Mm-hmm. I would think if she's like super kind to the sisters and not to him, she probably had issues with her own father or some male in her life. Would be my biggest guess for that. Not that that's like any sort of major like revelation, but she clearly seems to have some issue with males.
Yeah, his dad probably played a part in that too. So his parents, I guess they tried with their marriage, but both parents were much more engaged in his upbringing and well-being than a lot of parents were. But I guess Edmund was difficult. He was unduly afraid of being physically hurt by other boys and unstable to sustain friendships with his peers, which is weird because this dude's 6'9". He's not a little guy. He was unable to put the pain of his parents' divorce behind him. So that's when he started torturing and killing animals. You know, he entertained fantasies, which combined sex and violence from an early age. His mom... And by the way, this is all coming from he loves to do interviews. So there's years and years of interviews that he's given to a multitude of people. So this is all coming from his words at some point in time. His mom found him dour and unmanageable, and he was sent to Los Angeles, actually at his request, to live with his dad and his stepmom. And they, of course, had the same reaction as his mom did. You know, he was strange and it was threatening to him. And they were quickly pretty much at their wits' end for trying to figure out what to do with him. So basically being afraid of him, they sent him to his paternal grandparents, Maud and Edmund Kemper Sr. And they had a 17-acre farm in North Fork, California. And he was brought there during Christmas holidays of 1963. He wasn't jazzed to be left at the farm with his grandparents, you know, when the holidays ended, but He began school there and seemed to make at least some progress. His teachers at Sierra Joint Union High School in nearby Toll House, California, they found him quiet, rather meek, which is weird. It's hard to think of someone who's 6'9" as meek, but okay, maybe he wasn't quite that big yet. I don't know.
You know
He
what? Like, it
what?
seems like that happens pretty frequently. And like, as an ex-wrestling coach, the head coach, I was the assistant coach, and our head coach, Coach Flaherty, used to always say this about our bigger guys. Like, he thought he had like a theory of why there are the gentle giants, and it kind of made sense. If you think, if a kid is naturally bigger, right, like for their growing up period, their parents probably, or caregivers, or grandparents in Kemper's case, and or teachers probably all the time have to be like, "Oh, don't hurt them. Ooh, don't hurt them." Right. So as they grow up, they just become accustomed to not being aggressive.
Well, that makes
Whereas like
sense.
other kids in sports and things, you're like, "Come on, be aggressive. Come on, Bobby, you can do this." Right. Like, but like, I think their whole lives, these giant kids are being told, don't hurt them, don't touch them, because their
Yeah.
parents don't want them to break somebody.
Well, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, he obviously from a younger age was a bigger kid, being 6'9" as an adult. I don't think you start out small,
Yeah,
period.
right. That's what I'm saying, is like, probably, like, obviously everyone has a growth spurt that gets super tall, right? Like, I remember, I'm not super tall, but I'm like 5'10 and a half, and I was like 4'11 when I started high school, right? So I had a
Oh,
growth
wow.
spurt at some point, but I never was told not to hurt other kids. But I do think that, like you're saying, if you become 6'9, like, you're probably in grade school even like a half a foot taller than all the other kids, and probably have some weight on them, and just due to height, and, right? So like, yeah, they probably grow up kind of being held back from physical stuff because, again, kids are fragile. You don't want to be like having him out there accidentally breaking arms and stuff just because he's an aggressive giant kid.
Yeah, I can totally understand that. That does, it's actually very plausible. So his teachers are saying that he's meek, he didn't cause any trouble, made average grades, didn't really draw attention to himself, obviously apart from being a giant for the most part. And home with his grandparents, it was a tense situation, but it was bearable. They, I guess, found him disconcerting as his mother and father. But he kept busy and out from underfoot with his dog and a 22 rifle that his grandpa had given him. So he was shooting rabbits and gophers. He shot birds, even though he was told not to, but evidently was able to, I guess, contain his aggression to this one particular outlet. And at the end of the school year, he returned to his mom and his sisters in Helena, ostensibly to spend the summer. But 2 weeks, she sent him right back. So, old mama's not great for his
No, I was thinking of this too, as you've been talking about his growing up, and the mom had the borderline personality disorder issues, and how kind of sad the world is in terms of a lot of these emotional disorders, well, and physical disorders, and things are obviously genetic and biological, and they're passed down from parent to child. And it's like, so now you got this kid who's really messed up, right? So he's already a kid that's hard to raise. But he's hard to raise, and he doesn't have parents that have their shit together, right? So, because they've got their own issues. And it's like, so it's this thing that just spirals and gets worse and worse and worse until you actually have a good, positive, strong role model that pops up somewhere in the future of this family, right? It's like a downhill spiral. Or you become Ed Kemper and you get locked up and you can't have 10 million kids. I don't know if he had any, none. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just nuts, because it's almost like Darwinism, but the reverse side, right? You have survival of the fittest, where like genetics that are strong keep growing and those people keep reproducing. But then you have the opposite side, where it's like bad parents are raising bad kids, and they can't handle these kids because they had bad parents, and it just keeps going down and down and down. It's really scary.
Well, I mean, obviously his environment did play a huge part in kind of why he killed his victims, but He still had that sociopathic side. He was
Yeah.
still sociopathic slash
But
psychopathic.
is it chicken or egg? Like, do you think he's
Well,
born that
yeah.
way? Or,
I
I mean, the thing is,
don't know.
from someone who's in school for psychology, I think that like the days of like, this is my theory base that I rely on are kind of for the most part over. Like, even if people lean heavily towards like analytical or psychoanalytical versus like environmental, it's behavioral type of, I think most people think it's a combination, right? It's a
Yeah,
combination.
absolutely. I do too. But I think if you're sociopathic or psychopathic, I think it's you're born that way.
Yeah,
But
but I don't think, like you've said before, that doesn't necessarily mean you're a serial killer.
yeah, I mean, you can still have a bad upbringing and still not go on to that level of murderous
Right. And you can be a person
rage,
who doesn't have a lot of apathy, or sorry, a lot of empathy, and still not murder people, right? You just kind of stay to yourself and do your own stuff. Like maybe someone who's super career oriented and it's like, I'm just going to excel at my job and take care of me. That doesn't mean that they're a horrible human being out there killing people, but they might not care at all about other people, right?
Yeah, that's what we call CEOs. So,
CEOs, exactly.
yeah.
Yeah,
Not all, but yeah, come on.
again, my sister-in-law is a CEO. I don't think she listens to these, but just in case you do, Aaron, you are an exception.
We hope so, anyway. So, upon going back to his grandparents, his grandma had commented that he had regressed and he seemed a lot more sullen, more ominous. Now that he wasn't in school, he was always at the farm. And for his part, Ed found his grandma a nag and his grandfather a bore, which someone with such a high IQ, I can understand that. So,
Yeah, but again, like just like he's regressed. Well, you guys are ping pong balling him around town. Like he's going from
because you don't
father to
want
mother.
him.
Like, yeah, right. Like nobody wants this dude. He's being pushed around everywhere. It's like, oh, he's getting worse. Yeah, you think?
So his violent fantasies returned, this time centering around his grandma. He imagined her in the outhouse as he shot it full of holes. He lined her up, in the sights of his rifle and thought about what it would be like to kill her. And as the tension at the farm mounted, his grandma grew, more nervous. I'm sure she's picking up the shit that he's laying down a little bit. So she
And he's
actually,
giant, right? Like,
yeah,
I
he's
don't know how
giant.
big his grandma is. My grandmas were tiny.
Yeah, mine too. So she actually took his grandpa's 45 caliber pistol with her on at least one outing for fear, Ed would get it. And she had warned him not to touch it, but obviously didn't trust him to do as he was told. And Ed took this lack of trust as an insult and, of course, started brooding on it the whole summer, which caused tension to grow even more, as you might imagine. And on August 27th, 1964, Ed sat with his grandma at the kitchen table and they were going over proofs from a children's book she was writing. And looking up, she noticed apparently Ed had an odd stare and a frightening look that she'd seen before. And of course, it unnerved her. She told him to stop it. After a moment, Ed picked up his gun and whistled for his dog, saying he was headed out to shoot some gophers. And she warned him not to shoot the birds and returned her attention back to her work. And Ed turned around. And upon exiting the house, he watched her through the screen door. Her back was to him, and he raised his rifle and took aim at her head. He fired once, and she slumped down on the table. Then he
Man.
fired twice more, hitting her in the back inside the house again. He wrapped her head in a towel and dragged the body into the bedroom. Now, within a few minutes, Grandpa returned from, I guess he's buying groceries. And as he began to unload the truck, Edmund took aim and shot him in the back of the head.
Damn.
Yeah. So just killed both his grandparents.
You know why he forgot the Cocoa Puffs? You don't do that shit.
Well, actually, what he claimed is that he didn't want his grandfather to have to see what he did
Yeah.
and have to live
I'm
with it.
wondering, like, how, like, if someone's on the edge, right? Like, there's always something to push them over. I'm wondering, like, it's something we'll never know the answer to. If the grandma didn't say, hey, don't shoot the birds, If she had just been like, okay, enjoy gopher hunting with your dog, see ya, like, would she be alive?
You know, I think that it would have gotten to the point where she would have done something else that
Eventually,
bothered
yeah,
him,
but
you
in
know.
this encounter is like that statement, the thing that tipped him.
Yeah, I'd say it probably was because
Yeah.
his mom, she said something too that set him off at the end.
Yeah, he wasn't looking for restrictions in this case.
I don't know that it was necessarily that. I think it's just the bossiness and the aggressiveness
Yeah.
and,
And that's what
you
I meant. I
know.
meant like it was one too many nags.
Yeah,
Like, where
yeah.
like
And he kind
he
of
clearly
equated
was
his
not.
grandma to his mom, you know, both,
Yeah.
which actually I've got some audio clips that we'll listen to, and he kind of talks about both of them and how they were similar. So that didn't bode well for grandma from the beginning. So his grandparents typically weren't the kind to take off on sudden extended vacations, so he couldn't hide their bodies because their friends and family would miss them pretty much immediately. So confused and, of course, I guess scared. I mean, you'd have to be scared. He just killed two people, but he called his mom in Montana, who advised him to call the sheriff. He was taken in for questioning and soon confessed to both murders, saying he pretty much often thought about killing his grandma and that he'd killed his grandfather as an act of mercy to protect him from seeing his dead wife and possibly having a heart attack. Ed was incarcerated in juvenile hall while the California Youth Authority decided what to do with him, and a court-appointed psychiatrist diagnosed Ed as paranoid and psychotic, and the youth authority committed him to Atascadero State Hospital. He went in on December 6, 1964. Wasn't even 16 years old yet. So
Yeah.
they've got him as paranoid and psychotic. That's their diagnosis so far. So this state hospital, it's a secure facility, but it wasn't a prison. Like, there were no guard towers, and the purpose of a stay was treatment, not being punished for whatever crime you did. And Ed took an extensive battery of tests and began to gain insight, not just into the nature of his own crime, but into what others thought of that crime. He didn't accept actual responsibility for his crime, which is a big thing of narcissism, which he, when you hear some of his tapes I'll play later, you'll understand why I say he's narcissistic. But saying it had been beyond his control, but he worked hard at learning the language of the treatment and appearing to be recovered, quote unquote. He worked in the psychology laboratory and helped administer all the tests. So he took pride in doing a good job, which his doctors interpreted as a very good sign. Sociopaths, and he'd actually been diagnosed as that at Atascadero. They're usually reluctant and cooperative workers, but Ed seemed eager to do his best. So he's like master manipulator. Like, he
Yeah.
pretty
Why
much
would
memorized all those behavioral tests and knew exactly the answers to get.
Right, that's my problem. Like, why would they let this dude be administering these tests? Because during his time doing it, he's got to be picking up from the doctors and things like what they're looking for. You don't want somebody that you have to continue to test to know if they're okay to put in the general public to know what you're looking for. Most of these tests have such obscure questions that like you literally are answering things that have nothing to do with it, and there's things that they're looking for blended in to them so that only someone who's trained to assess it can do it, but you're giving this guy that knowledge.
Well, he's very personable and likes to talk. And when you hear some of these tapes, you'll understand why. I mean, he's very Ted Bundy-ish in the fact that he's very charismatic and very intelligent when he speaks. And you just want to sit and listen to him when he's talking, which, you know, I think is how he got away with a lot of the shit that he got away with at that hospital.
Yeah.
But while he was there, he got to know a lot of people, like serial rapists, you know, who would tell him their stories. And keep in mind, he's not 16 yet. So he's impressionable. And, you know, that his sexual awareness kind of became linked with domination and violence. So that's kind of how he grew into his sexual age or whatever. which, you know, unfortunately, because of where he was, that kind of thinking wasn't perverse. You know, it was normal because of the type of people he was in there with. So his violent sexual fantasies became intricate and intense, and he took note of what the incarcerated rapists around him had done wrong. They had been caught because they hadn't been smart, and they left witnesses and evidence. So he's already pretty much plotting his murder trail right here before he can even drive legally. You know, the people he's with, they attacked women they knew, or they did their attacking in too public of a place. You know, listening to all these people, he's filing this information in like a corner of his mind. So, although he hadn't formed any concrete plans, he knew each fact, each story would be useful to him later. He was smart enough that he didn't share his fantasies with his doctors. So for them, he basically just behaved and worked hard. You know, he claimed religious conversion and took to looking up any biblical reference he heard. And he a clean-cut guy. He was conservative. He's intelligent and sheltered. And when he was released in 1969, the changes that had occurred on the outside world must have come as quite a shock. You know, he renewed contact with the outside. His renewed contact began at a community college near Atascadero. While he attended school, he was still under the supervision of the youth authority. When he was released, though, the doctors had told, I guess, the board or whoever does the releasing, not to put him back with his mother, which they didn't listen to, and he went right back to his mom. So he was,
Yeah, but why are we releasing a guy when there's that kind of stipulation? It's like, you know what? I think if we stick him with his mother, he might kill her, but we're gonna let him go.
I don't know if it was the thought of him killing her, but just, you know, I'm assuming he talked about how difficult it was, and, you know, a
Yeah,
lot of
maybe it just
his,
isn't good for his actual healing and yeah.
exactly. Now Ed, he was kind of what they would call a square. You know, there was a lot of hippies that sported the long hair and, you know, flouted authority, while he, with his short hair and his neat little mustache, which he still has, he actually wanted to be a cop, and his hopes were dashed by that because there was a minimum height requirements to both the local and state police. They also had maximum height limits, so he was too tall to be a cop, which is so weird. But you know, to get over his disappointment, he bought a motorcycle. You know, with it, he could at
Wouldn't
least
you
feel like a
think
cop.
that
What?
murdering your grandparents, even as a child, would be criteria for not being able to be a cop?
Not if it's not charged as a felony and it gets sealed, which I think is
Wow.
what happened.
Yeah, I mean, and you're probably right, but like I just think of all the, I mean, there was a hometown case, Bobby Cutts, if anyone's interested in cop killers, right, where he killed this girl he was dating. And there's so many cases where like cops have like stepped over the lines, and they do psychological tests, like right, for police officers, but clearly they're not sufficient because so many have done bad things. And I'm not saying all cops are bad. I mean, most cops don't do these things.
Right.
But my point is, I don't think sealing that to the police and then allowing this person to be a police officer, right? I mean, obviously he didn't because of his height, but had he not had the height restriction, I don't think that's okay.
Well, I don't think he would have been able to get into it anyway, just because he was locked up in Atascadero, and, you know, given his diagnoses, I don't
Yeah.
think they would would, because I
Right.
mean,
He probably would have gotten stopped for other reasons along the
well, I mean,
way.
you have to go through like a psychological background, I think, even to be a 911 operator. So
Yeah.
it's probably even more intense for cops. So I don't know if they did that back then, but that could definitely be one of the stopping points too.
Yeah. I mean,
Don't.
luckily he got bumped out for height, and it's a moot
Yeah.
point, but it's
Because
just kind
he
of
would have been
scary
able
to
to
think
beat it,
he
you
could have been a
know.
cop, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
Because
exactly.
you know what he would
So
have done as a cop? Look, we don't need a crystal ball. He would have been
no.
using that power to kill people,
Oh
right?
yeah, which is that's what the Hillside Stranglers did. They
Yeah.
posed as cops. Now his mom, while he was, you know, in his, her last name was Strandberg now, because she had gotten married and then divorced again. She had a position as an administrative assistant on University of California at Santa Cruz campus. Apparently, she was well liked, and the absence of her son had given her several years of relative peace, ex-husband aside, of course. But they had verbal battles that were loud enough to be heard by the neighbors. Pretty much as soon as Edmund got back, into the duplex where she lived, she still harangued and she blamed him. And Ed would later claim that she hounded him relentlessly about matters like as trivial as whether he should get his teeth cleaned, and he often sought refuge at the jury room, which was a local bar frequented by off-duty police and deputies. And he was still fascinated by law enforcement and whiled away many an hour discussing the merits and shortcomings of various sorts of, guns and ammunitions with officers. He was respectful and they called him Big Ed, being 6'9", of course they did. So thanks to his mom, working at the college, that's where he kind of trolled for and got and picked up a lot of his victims. Not all of them, but some of them, had a lot of rage towards her. His victims are the one who suffer for it. And, it's also something that there was the need for killing, which he hadn't yet experienced, but it's a thing that a lot of the serial killers talk about. It's that addiction or that feeling that they need. And I have a video. Go ahead.
Quick question before you play that, like the parents that died, were those his mom's parents or his dad's parents?
His dad's, it's his paternal grandparents.
Okay. I mean, it's still bad because I like the first thing I thought, like, that when he's going back to his mom is like, how horrible for her.
Oh yeah.
This kid
Well,
just killed two people and now he's put back with, it's like, I don't want him to live with me.
yeah, and he actually, from what I understand, they didn't like each other, so she's probably
But
like,
you'd be
fuck
terrified. You've
it,
got this 6'9"
I don't
child that killed two people.
know if she was necessarily afraid of him so much as,
She should have been.
well, no, she definitely should have been, but she hated him, basically. So it's kind of
I
like,
would treat him real
damn.
nice.
Well, I would too, know what we know now for sure.
Mean, even
Yeah.
just knowing that he killed his grandparents, which she did know, I would treat him real nice.
You were involved in the campus because your mother worked there.
Yes. I was also involved in killing co-eds because my mother was associated with college work, college co-eds, women, and had had a very strong and violently outspoken position on men for much of my upbringing. My mother was a sick, angry, hungry, and very sad woman. I hated her, but I wanted to love my mother. And I watched the alcohol increase. I watched her social life drop off. I watched her get bizarre. She had terrible pain from her life, earlier life, her upbringing, a failed marriage with my father. I'm a constant reminder of that failure. I hate to distill it down into one-word realities like that. There's a lot that leads into that happening, but that is what happened. They represented not what my mother was, but what she liked, what she coveted, what was important to her, and I was destroying it.
Why did you actually kill the girls?
My frustration, my inability to communicate socially, sexually. I wasn't impotent, but emotionally I was impotent. I was scared to death of failing in male-female relationships. I knew absolutely nothing about that whole area. Even if just sitting down and talking with the young lady, I need to be able to really communicate. And ironically enough, that's why I began picking people up. And I'm picking up young women. And I'm going a little bit farther each time. It's a daring kind of a thing. At first, there wasn't a gun. I'm driving along. We go to a vulnerable place where there aren't people watching, where I could act out. And I say, no, I can't. And then a gun is in the car, hidden. And this craving, this awful, raging, eating feeling inside. I could feel it consuming my insides. This fantastic passion. It was overwhelming me. It was like drugs. It was like alcohol. A little isn't enough. At first it is. And as you adjust to that psychologically and physically, you take more and more and more. It's the same process. So it finally came down to the thing of, do I dare bring this gun out? Already realizing if that gun comes out, something has to happen. It was going to happen. I didn't see it then, but it was going to happen. I was playing a dangerous game with a loaded gun. It got us all.
First thing I had to do was take off my glasses and look at them to see if me and Ed Kemper had the same glasses. That would be
a little bit different.
They're a little bit different. But his very first statement really caught me the most, which was, he said, because he was like, so your mom worked at the university. He's like, yeah, and because of that, I killed co-eds. It's like, you didn't kill co-eds because your mom works at the university. You killed co-eds because you are a killer. Your mom's job has nothing to do with what you do. But like, his hatred of her is so intense that even the killing of the co-eds, he's like, that's kind of my mom's fault.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Well, you'll never hear him take actual responsibility for anything, which typical of a narcissist. But do you see what I mean by how he seems very easy to talk to and just very forthcoming with whatever he thinks someone wants to hear?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, even his thing about like it being bad in relationships and all this, like, I relate to a lot of that, right? Like, I can understand that. I feel the same way, but that doesn't make you a killer, right? Like, right.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people are bad at relationships, but not a lot of people are serial killers.
This is true. This is true that we know of anyway. So Ed took various positions as a laborer, finally secured one with the Division of Highways, which enabled him to actually move out of his mom's home and into an apartment in Alameda, which he shared with a friend.
He lived in Alameda?
Mm-hmm.
I'm like right by you right now.
Oh, that's why. Oh, could have been your neighbor 30 years ago. Yeah.
I got to find out where he lived.
I don't know if I have that information. I think I've watched everything on Ed Kemper. I probably can look back somewhere and find out. But even though he didn't live with Mama, you know, she still continued to berate and belittle him. And he actually wrecked his motorcycle twice. I don't know if that was due to his mom, you know, running off at the mouth. The Division of Highways gave him time off to recuperate from his broken left arm after the second accident. And with an out-of-court settlement, he bought a car that looked very much like an unmarked police vehicle. So still got that cop dream going on here. He equipped it with a radio transmitter and a microphone and a large whip antenna. Do you remember those things? My grandparents used to have one of those whip antennas.
Radio with the large antennas?
Sword. Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. They were like lethal, right?
And yeah,
like,
oh my God, that hurt like hell.
The edge would cut you. And they had all kinds of issues, but you could whip them. Yeah.
Hell yeah. I used to love that thing all the time. But he actually started to pick up hitchhikers, small, pretty female hitchhikers. He watched how they reacted to him. He learned how to make them trust him. You know, he took them safely to wherever they were going. And privately, he, you know, indulged in his violent fantasies, imagining what he would do to his captive hitchhikers when he finally got all the details taken care of, like all of the possibilities seen to. So he began to outfit his car for his future plans. The antenna came off and the passenger door was rigged to keep it from being open from the inside. Plastic bags, knives, guns, and a blanket went into the trunk. And Ed picked up a girl. Well, he basically picked up girl after girl, treating each of them as like an experiment, basically just waiting for his moment. And it took a while, actually more than a year of picking up and letting these girls go. But on May 7th, 1972, his moment finally came. And I've got a couple videos to play on how he was able to pick up these girls and how he kind of just seemed very unassuming, which I don't know if it's the glasses and the fact that he looked kind of dorky that
you can be giant and unassuming.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, I was like actually like judging him in that other video. Like, I shouldn't be judging people because of being weak killers, but like, I'm like, this dude's hiding a gun in the car. He's 6'9", bro.
Yeah. I mean, they just, They just don't think about it. I mean, he's
No,
just.
I mean, he could snap one of these people's necks like a twig, but he's got a gun.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine how huge his hands are? I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
A nice guy.
Did you like Kemper?
I like Kemper.
You were able to appear like an ordinary person, non-threatening to.
I lived as an ordinary person most of my life, even though I was living a parallel and increasingly sick life, other life. One victim let me back in the car. I locked myself out. She opened the door for me. My gun was under the seat. What in the hell am I doing telling you that? Am I a masochist? Am I looking to be tormented further? I'm trying to show you just how awful this got, how commanding these rages got. I was raging inside. There was just incredible energies, positive and negative, depending on a mood that would trigger one or the other. And outside, I looked troubled at times. Other times, I looked moody. Other times, perfectly serene. Not very sane. But again, people weren't even aware of what was happening.
Yeah, you know, it's a definite benefit to the world that there are some serial killers who... It's a weird statement, but there are serial killers who are this well-spoken, right? Because he can actually... very well express how a serial killer feels, right? Like, and a lot of them can't, so it's a benefit for sure.
Well, actually, when the FBI's behavioral analysis unit was forming, they interviewed him a lot.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how he helped kind of bring that about, that whole big unit of what it is now.
Yeah.
Bundy.
I was thinking too, like, he's tall, which women tend to like.
Yeah.
And they keep talking about how he's unassuming, but he's also not bad looking, right? Like,
no.
I feel like he's probably very appealing to women.
Yeah. I mean, I, you know,
like a Bundy,
get
right?
Past,
so it's
you know,
easy
like
to catch
the
people.
70s mustache and everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think,
right. But this was in the
70s,
right?
Well,
so
yeah.
I feel like,
yeah.
Right. So I feel like Bundy, when he's picking people up,
mm-hmm.
It's probably super easy for him because they need rides, right? They're mostly hitchhikers, but they're probably also like, ooh, this guy's cute, right? So they're
yeah.
like, it's not a scary thing for them.
Right.
My mother worked at the campus and I had an A sticker on my car and obvious access day or night to the campus. I was picking up some very lovely young women. You know what we were talking about as we're driving around? Almost as often as not, this guy that's going around doing this stuff. And the second they started talking that, they didn't realize it, but they were getting a free ride. I couldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole, I swear. You know, but they'd be telling me what all about this guy, and they're comparing notes and speculating on what he looks like, how he carries himself, why he's doing this stuff, telling me about it.
So how come they get in a car with somebody at that time?
She judged me not to be that guy. I didn't look like him.
Fatal mistake.
Yeah.
Which I get it, you know. I wouldn't hitchhike now just because, you know, crazy people like this, but you know, back then.
Yeah, I want to say I wouldn't then, but it's hard to say that because so many did. I mean,
yeah.
Clearly if you have beautiful young girls. Are exactly the type of people who should never hitchhike, but back
yeah.
then all of them did, so clearly people thought it was safe.
Pretty much, yeah. Actually, you know, they still hitchhike in Romania very frequently. That's how people
yeah.
get around a lot, which safe route there, you know. I mean, I guess
it's still kind of scary because it's only stuff like that's only safe until it's not, right?
Yeah, true. Very true. Very, very true. So his first killings on May 5th, 1972, Mary Ann Pesci, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, I apologize. And Anita
Pesci,
Lucchesi.
Like
it could be Pesci, I'm not sure. Could be. And Anita Lucchesi were students at Fresno State College, and they were hitchhiking to Stanford after a couple of days they for you know being in Berkeley or whatever. They never reached their destination, and the families of both filed missing persons reports. You know, cops, of course, during that time didn't pay much attention to, they just chalked it off as, oh, they're kids, they'll come back when they want to or whatever. Typical. But Ed drove him around for a bit. He took his gun out from under the seat and pulled off into a deserted area. Now he put Anita in the trunk of his car and turned his attention toward Marianne. He handcuffed her, laid her across the back seat face down. He put a plastic bag over her head and attempted to strangle her with a length of terry cloth, but she was actually able to bite a hole in the bag and the cloth snapped. So he pulled out his knife and he stabbed her repeatedly. He actually eventually slashed her throat. So he removed Anita from the trunk and with a larger knife, he began to stab her. She fought and screamed, but he eventually wore her down, of course. Now he drove around with the bodies in the car for a while, trying to figure out what the hell to do. And he eventually brought Marianne's body into his apartment where he undressed and dissected her. He also beheaded Anita's body. Marianne's body was buried in a plastic bag. He used to try to suffocate her, and later Ed would actually lead police to the site. He kept both of their heads for a while, basically just eventually disposing of them in a ravine. Marianne's was found and identified in August, but neither Anita's head nor her body was ever found. And I do have a video of him talking about it. It's insane, just the matter of factness, and he just talks about it. It's just very conversational.
Killing in May of 72, when that gun was pulled out, I launched it out for it. I had it under my leg, out of sight, parallel to my leg in the seat. It was something that had been thought out in fantasy, acted out, felt out hundreds of times before it ever happened.
Kemper drove them at gunpoint to a secluded area near a park. He took one of them into the woods, leaving the second girl tied in the car.
I'd just gone through a horrible experience with her roommate stabbing her. And I was in shock because of that. I couldn't believe that it was that way. And I'm walking back there bewildered. I gotta kill her. I can't let her go. She's gonna tell on me. Everybody's gonna get me. She sees the blood on my hands. What are you doing? And she pulled back and she gasped. And I think, whoa, I don't want her to know what happened. I said, your friend got smart with me. She'd been getting really smart with me a lot, but I never hit her. I killed her, but I didn't hit her. I said, your friend got smart with me and I hit her. I think I broke her nose. You better come help. She's about to die. Why does she have to know that? I couldn't deal with telling her that. And when I attacked her, she didn't at first realize what was happening. It didn't go through. She had very heavy coveralls on. It knocked her right up into the lid of the car, but it didn't pierce the clothing. So wasn't that swell a knife anyway. I went out and bought a pawn shop huge knife, and I kept on just mindlessly attacking. She falls back into the trunk. I just killed a young woman. I slammed down the lid of the trunk. She isn't dead, she's dying. And I panicked. I thought, I just locked the car keys in because I can't find them in my pocket. Oh my God, I locked him in the trunk. I'm kicking on the trunk lid and yanking on it. Oh no, I don't believe this. I started to run and I tripped over the gun that I'd had in my pants that I had totally forgotten was there. I stopped, I said, stop and think. I collected my wits. Check all your pockets. I picked the gun up, I stuck it back in my pants, now remembering I had one. I checked all my pockets and there's the keys in the back pocket. I never put them in my back pocket.
Everyone makes mistakes, and that's what we have to hope for. The more mistakes they make, the better their chances.
I thought I was pretty slick and went and tripped all over myself that first two murders. The first 24 hours, there were three clear times I should have been busted, and I wasn't, because three different individuals or three different groups of people got scared and minded their own business and looked the other way.
One thing that really jumps out at me with this is when he's talking about killing the first girl, he's like, he made a point to say, I didn't hit her.
I
You know,
didn't hit her, right?
I'm not a woman abuser. I'm a
Right.
killer, but I didn't hit her.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I was thinking how frazzled he is during this whole experience, because if he had locked the keys in the trunk and he has a firearm, what should he do?
Blow the lock off.
Shoot the trunk. Like,
Right.
don't try to, like, he say pulled on it for a while, then he panicked and ran. It's like, you have a gun, bro.
Yeah, he I don't know, just the way he describes things, it's just so conversational, you know. Just like, I don't know. I don't know. But you know, of course no one suspected Mr. Polite Clean Cut Ed of anything untoward, so he continued to do his prowling, and on the evening of September 14th, 1972, he picked up Aiko Koo, who was a 15-year-old dancer. She was Korean, and she was on her way to dance class. And she had tired of, I guess she'd been waiting for the bus for a while and decided to hitchhike. So apparently not a good thing. He picked her up, but she caught on to his plan and panicked. And he convinced her that he was planning to use a gun to kill himself, and that if she didn't try to signal police or passersby, she wouldn't be harmed. So he drove into the mountains, turned off the main road, parked out of sight. He taped her mouth, tried to suffocate her by putting his thumb and index finger in her nostrils.
So weird.
And, right?
So weird. He's
And,
got, he's like you say, he's probably got giant hands. He's 6'9". Even if he
yeah.
doesn't have giant hands, she's a tiny little 15-year-old
Yeah.
dancer, right?
And
Like,
that's, yeah.
put your hand over her nose and mouth
Yeah,
and
just
hold
pinned her
it there.
nose shut.
Right. I mean, why would you ever just jam your fingers in her nostrils thinking that's going to work?
Maybe it was like an act of some kind of penetration,
Yeah, it's
something along
weird.
those lines.
I mean, because have you ever heard of anyone else doing that? I
No, because
have
I
never
mean,
heard that.
like you said, his hands had to be huge, and like my hands are small, and it's hard for me to jam my fingers into my
Yeah.
nose. I
And
can't,
one of
there's
them he
no
said was
way.
his thumb.
Yeah, like his thumb and his
Yeah,
pointer finger,
it's very
whatever.
bizarre.
Yeah,
It's bizarre and it
there's no
seems
way
like
he
it
could have done
wouldn't
that.
be possible. Yeah.
Or he just did it so damn hard, ripped her nostrils or something, but
Oh.
she actually did pass out. But she awoke again not very long, and he began to suffocate her again. This time he was able to do it until she stopped breathing completely. He took her out of the car, he laid her on the ground, and he raped her. With her own scarf, he actually strangled her. And when he was absolutely sure she was dead, he put her body in the trunk and drove away from the scene. He actually stopped at a local bar, had a couple of beers. After that, he went to his mom's house. Now, from time to time, he would go to the trunk to open it up and look at her. And late that night, he brought her body into his apartment and placed it on his bed. He dissected her just as he had done with Marianne and Anita, and disposed of her head and hands in a different location than the rest of her body. Now, very little of her ever turned up, and her disappearance was not thought to be related to Marianne and Anita. Of course not. So 4 months had passed. Other victims of other killers were found in the Bay Area, and public concern was growing, of course, but Ed wasn't under any suspicion for any of the killings. On January 8th, 1973, he bought a 22 caliber automatic pistol, even though he was forbidden to own a firearm because of his prior crime. But he didn't have any trouble whatsoever purchasing the gun. But he also feared that eventually the cops might catch on to the fact that he was in illegal possession of a handgun. So he stepped up his cruising and killing activities that very day. That same day, he picked up Cindy and drove her into the hills near Watsonville, where he forced her into the trunk and he shot her with his new gun. The bullet got lodged in her skull. Ed had recently moved back in with his mom, so he brought the body to the duplex in Aptos and into his room there. And when Clarnell left for work the next morning, he had sex with Cindy's corpse. He dissected her in the bathtub, you know, of course, washed away all the traces of what he'd done. He was actually able to remove the bullet from her skull and buried the head in his mother's backyard. Later, he threw the body parts, which he had put into plastic bags off a cliff. This time, the body was actually discovered within 24 hours. So, you know, he took notice of it, but he wasn't really worried. You know, he'd been extraordinarily careful. And within a month, he was actually ready to kill again. And he was He was very bold in doing the shit that he did, like beheading his victims where he could easily get caught. You know, I think he actually, I think the first two, I think one was beheaded in the trunk of his car, like on the backside of his building. So somebody could have walked around there and seen him doing that. So he's
Yeah. And it's
getting a
something we
little
talk about a
cocky.
lot. And then Kemper mentioned it himself, and but you and I talk about it a lot too. It's just escalating, right? It's quickly escalating.
Yeah, it very much is.
All right, everybody. Thank you for joining us for our Ed Kemper episode of Through the Abyss podcast. As always, we thank you for joining us on whatever platform you use, and we appreciate you as always.
And be sure to tune in next week for part two of our Ed Kemper series. And if you want to get in touch with us, all of our social links are on www.throughtheabysspodcast.com. Well, Ben, we got another episode under our belts. Thanks so much for tuning in to Through the Abyss podcast. And until next time, keep it weird.
Spooky stuff!